Welcome to the Edu All-Stars Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome to the 26th episode of Edu All-Stars. My name is Todd Nesloni, and it's great to have you here. My co-host with me today is...
This is Chris Kessler. You can find me on Twitter at I am Kessler.
And we are really excited today for our guest. We have Steve Spangler, who is a science author, teacher, professional speaker, toy designer. I love the flames.
I'm award-winning television. Before we got started, how's that? Just a little bit of light reading. It's called Hands-On Science. I think I'm going to put it off to the side, but we should read this. I'll send you a copy.
Perfect.
Hey, there we go.
Off the fire alarms. Have you ever seen 50,000 gallons of water up here? It's going to in just seconds. So.
Well, let me tell you, that's the best intro we have had of any guest to come with fire blazing. But Steve, thank you so much for coming with us today. I'll let Chris speak on this.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been following Steve for quite some time. I use a lot of his experiments in my own classroom. We did some stuff with the after-school program at my school with lots of Steve Spangler stuff. Last Halloween, I actually made the local newspaper by doing all kinds of Steve Spangler experiments. I kind of turned my room into this mad scientist laboratory, and I had every faculty member in there, and people from the admin building came over, and parents, and it was just like this really awesome experience. And the reality is that these kids aren't going to remember the rock cycle when they grow up and they're 20 years later down the road, but they're going to remember that day, and that's what we're all about here. So,
well, you know what? I'm going to beg to differ. They're going to remember the rock cycle because they're going to remember you. And the kicker for me is this: is if at a kid's 20-year reunion they say, "Hey, you remember Kessler? He was crazy, man. He was out of control, this guy." That you've planted the seed. You know, I don't think there's a kid out there. Now I'm old enough to have been to my 25th high school reunion. And I'll promise you, 10 sucks and 20 is okay and 25 is really awesome just because people are who they are. But more importantly, the conversation is very cool because it's not, hey, remember that worksheet we did in 8th grade? Nobody ever says that, you know?
No,
remember when you got an A because you lit your hand on fire, you're at a B+, and HOTUS lets you have an A if you'd light your hand on fire to teach ethanol and what, you know, whatever else? And today you go to jail for doing that with kids. Back in 1985, that was an okay kind of thing. And those are the experiences. So I think it's a wonderful way for us to start to talk a little bit because it really, the science is cool, but it really is all about those experiences.
Very cool.
Well, you know, we always like to start with our guests getting a little background information on them on how they actually ended up in education. So, I mean, do you currently teach a class with students now?
No, I don't get to currently do that. I am under contract with the Littleton Public Schools here in Colorado, which means that I get a chance to be able to kick open a door every once in a while and test out some new material. But more importantly, from 2003 until now, all that time has been devoted to teacher training. And so prior to that, I was in the classroom from 1991 to 2003. I had classroom responsibilities in the Cherry Creek School District here in Colorado. Had a wonderful principal who was able to work my schedule at school around the opportunities that had come my way. Because when you go knock on your principal's door and say, I got this opportunity to work for NBC Television, and they kind of want a Mr. Wizard, but I haven't learned how to be a great teacher yet. And she goes, "I know, and I'll work with you on that, and we're going to find a way to be able to do that together." And so it really has been just a wonderful opportunity to have these people come into your life and go, "I'll guide you if you'll listen." I guess maybe that's the key, is when people give you advice and you trust them and you listen to them, some amazing things can happen. When you try to fight it, you're going to go off in your own direction anyway. But if you listen to their advice, some really cool things can happen.
Now, did you always want to be a teacher?
Probably deep down inside, I always wanted to be a teacher, but you have to dig a little bit deeper. I grew up in a family. My first recollection of my dad doing his work was I was backstage peeking out the curtain, and he was cutting my mom into three pieces. So she's in the box and cuts her into three pieces and pulls the center section out, and the crowd, and there's an orchestra. That's how, you know, so I'm talking, this is a while ago, right? So about 1970 or so. And there's a little orchestra, and Dad eats fire at the end, and my mom eats fire, and my mom and Dad were professional magicians. Now, I didn't realize that that's not what their real jobs were. My dad was really an IT guru who helped at the very beginning of the internet stuff and in telecommunications and so forth, and worked on the compact disc years and years and years ago for that patent and so forth. And he's a chemist. So my dad was a chemist by degree, a magician on the side. But when I was a kid, people like this little unknown guy by the name of David Copperfield would come to the house. And David came to the house in Denver. And so I was about 10 years old asking him for an autograph. But he was sitting with my dad saying, I'm going to have this special coming up, and we're going to do this, this, and this. And what are your thoughts, and how can I do this a little bit better? So my dad ran, in addition to doing his IT stuff, my dad ran a magic school in Colorado. So some of the best names in magic would come through Denver, Colorado, and attend the magic school or be a part of the magic school. So I think I always wanted to be a teacher. I just didn't know it. And science was just this natural thing, you know. My dad taught chemical magic as a class. I was fascinated by chemical magic. So you can imagine when I was in eighth grade and we had a little bit of chemistry, I could hardly wait to break out the phenolphthalein and the sodium hydroxide and do the wine water trick or whatever. And it just formed this bond with these teachers that to this day, I still interact with many of these teachers who are long retired, but this was the very beginning of realizing that this was what the passion was and this is what I needed to be doing. It's kind of a cool way to think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So your passion for science is obviously evident. What role does passion play for a science teacher, or really for any teacher for that matter?
Oh, 100%. Well, okay, 99.9 and then that 0.1. Yeah, so this is an ongoing battle, right? Because you have people who are passionate, but they lack the content. And you have the people who are content-oriented, and they have plenty of content, and they lack the passion. And both extremes are very difficult. But I can tell you the people that have more passion and less content probably will affect more lives in the future than those people who are content-rich, and you're going to get it their way, or you can go to somebody else and get it. And maybe the best way to put it is that we've been running these teacher training camps for almost 20 years. And when I was teaching at Regis University here in Denver, there was a teacher here in Denver that came through, and a wonderful teacher didn't know, she couldn't teach herself out of a paper bag in terms of science, but her passion was here. She wanted to present at a National Science Teachers Association meeting, and it's like, oh, okay, we're going to do this, but it was everything that we could do to get the content, but it didn't matter because the content came, her passion was there, and the audience and these teachers could see it, and you could see she would stumble on, is it hydrophilic, is it hydrophobic, and you'd see her go, it doesn't matter, the kids love this, and then she'd do the demo, and I'd be the one going, no, it does matter, it does, it's hydrophobic, but it's hard to teach passion, it's easy to teach content, it's hard to teach passion. And I'll promise you that someday, sometime, a kid's going to walk up to her and go, do you remember me? And it's a pretty cool thing to have made an impact on a kid enough for them to come back later on in life and go, do you remember me? And to realize that there is that connection.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, I know you also do some stuff for some different television programs and things like that. When was the first time that you were invited to do something on television?
I was teaching. It was 1991. I had just gotten this little teaching position as a science specialist at Willow Creek Elementary, and there was a producer in Denver who was working local television, our local NBC affiliate, who was responsible for children's programming, and the FCC said you had to do so much programming per year, and so they came up with a concept called News for Kids, and you know, we as teachers love what we do so much that we actually get another job on the side because we make so much money, you know, and we just find ourselves getting another job. Well, I was doing library shows, all right? So I'm going and putting my crap in a trunk, and I'm doing my little library show, and I'm lighting my book on fire going, hey, kids, I'm excited about science. Now, this whole thing, and she sees me, and she goes, how would you like to be a part of the show? And when I went back to my principal and said, hey, I've got this little opportunity to work for this show, that was the first piece. It was called News for Kids. I get to host the science part of News for Kids. It was a nationally syndicated program, so we started rolling pretty hard about 1995, pre-internet, so we were sending out experiments by fax. If you send us your number, we would fax you an experiment. Wow. Or we'd take an experiment, fold it up on a piece of paper, and send it out and so forth. But I realized at the time that what I was teaching people to do is not science. I was teaching people how to be amazing. And as weird as that catchphrase is, when you empower somebody else to be able to do something and to feel the adrenaline rush that we as teachers get, because that's really special. When you're standing in front of a class and those kids get it and you look into their eyes and those kids look back at you and go, I got it. You know, there's a little thing there. That's like a drug. And if I could give that to a kid and they could feel that same way when they're doing a couple table tricks in front of mom and dad on Thanksgiving, how cool is that? It's the greatest thing in the world. So that really was the beginning of the television career. I did maybe 250 episodes with News
for Kids. Wow.
And I just celebrated, we've almost crossed over 1,500 episodes in 20 years. So 1,500 television appearances in 20 years. Worked for KUSA-TV, 9 News here in Denver. Many teachers get that feed because they get our Experiment of the Week or they get some of those things that they see that we've got this wonderful crew in Denver, and people on the satellite pick it up every once in a while and so forth. So it just keeps you in practice. Every Monday morning at 6:30 in the morning and at 4 p.m., there's a live piece. So if you're like we're doing a News for Kids or a regular episode, and the light comes on, which means I got to come up with content. And I've got to come up with content that I think that a million people watching at 4:45 in the afternoon might want to watch. And it just makes you focus on the learner versus focusing on the stuff that you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know, like, when I always tell my wife about people who are coming on the show, and she's always like, I don't know who these people are. And so then I was telling her, I said, yeah, Steve Spangler's coming on. And she's like, is that the guy that goes on the Ellen show, the science guy? And I said, yes, that's him. And, you know, Chris and I have both seen those, and a lot of teachers know you from the Ellen DeGeneres show. What was that like, going on that kind of show, and how did that come about?
Believe it or not, that came about because of a thing that people sign up for called the Experiment of the Week. So if you go to experimentoftheweek.com or stevespanglerscience.com or whatever, people would put in their name, and every week I'd send them an experiment. And the experiment that, before we started Sick Science, the experiment that I would send them was whatever I do on television on that Monday. So Experiment of the Week was always Wednesday. It gave me 2 days to capture it, put it up there, do the write-up, and send it out. And one of the producers on the Ellen show was in a meeting, and he had built the balancing nails. So you know what I'm talking about? You take the nail and jam it into the piece of wood. You try to balance 9 more nails on the head of the 10th nail. So he's doing that, and one of the producers says, what are you doing? And he goes, oh, I saw this on this email that I get all the time, this website, whatever. And they're going, well, who is that? And that led to the phone call that led to, what would you think about coming on and doing something with her? And I can just tell you that Ellen DeGeneres has been very, very nice to us, very, very kind, has done a tremendous amount to kind of help us advance science. I guess my passion and the real thing that I'm doing is finding the most creative ways to get kids excited about science. So if I use that as my mission statement, finding the most creative ways to get kids excited and doing science, then I don't care if they're doing it by watching Ellen or they're doing it by watching a YouTube video or an activity they found at the store or McDonald's now is carrying the Sick Science videos. It doesn't matter. It's just my job as a cheerleader. Chris and Todd, it's your job to hit the home run in the classroom. It's mm-hmm. every other teacher's job out there to do the heavy lifting and to teach the real content. It's my job just to get the neurons going enough so they at least come to you with a smile going, what do you do? Because I saw this thing on TV. Do you do the same kinds of things? Probably better. And that's defining those roles, which has been difficult. And some science teachers just, they're not big Steve Spangler fans because of that. You know, it's just like, well, he's left teaching and he's just doing this fluff stuff or whatever. But I've had to come to grips with this is what my job is and this is what your job is. And together we can probably make a pretty significant difference. But it's hard for one person to be everything to everybody.
Exactly.
Let's talk about stevespanglerscience.com for a second. So when did you decide that I'm going to turn this passion of mine in science and experiments and all those things into a business?
You remember when I talked about that teaching career and how much money teachers make? about that moment in time. I got the opportunity to do teacher in services. And here I am at 24, 25 years old being asked to come in and do a teacher in service. The truth of the matter was there were teachers there that had more sick days than I had probably ever been in the classroom. You know what I mean? So how can I in-service a teacher? What in the world would I have? So all I had to offer was this repertoire of really cool science demos and stuff that I had been passionate about for 10 years. Because as a high school kid, I was doing science demos. And that's all I could offer them. So, you know, one leads to the next that leads to the next, and all of a sudden you realize kind of what your role is. Is it to sell science toys? Is it to do assemblies for kids? Is it to be the science guy before Bill Nye was ever the science, you know, that kind of thing, you know? And I think what you have to do is just to realize, what do you do best? Where can you make the biggest impact in the short term that you have on this planet? And then you're out, and hopefully somebody else carries the torch and kind of goes for it. So the business part of it, again, is part of that piece where people go, he's not a real teacher because now he started a business. And hopefully people understand that the reason to start the business is because when I was doing these teacher in services, I was going to go to Walmart and buy this, and then get some Marvel Mystery Oil, and then go to Depot and get this piece of – and so we just ended up starting to put that stuff in poly bags and put the instructions and started marketing that. Mm-hmm. We grew from – my wife and I would do this in the living room. And at night, you know, I come home from teaching school or doing a school assembly or starting, you know, doing that whole circuit. When as soon as I joined NBC Television, they put me on a speaking circuit. So now all of a sudden you're hitting as many elementary schools in Colorado as you could. And that's why my school district was very flexible with what I got to do. There was a time that I was doing almost 700 school assembly programs a year. Oh, and by means, I mean a school assembly program. That's an hour program. So I was logging about 700 hours and about, 20,000-30,000 miles around Colorado doing school programs. But I got a chance to see a lot of teachers in a lot of classrooms in those environments, and you start to see things that are, this is what makes a teacher very effective, and then you'd see those teachers that weren't necessarily as effective as they could be. And when you start seeing those patterns and you just sit back and you learn, I tell people in presentations all the time, I can tell a lot about your school if you'll let me to just sit in your teacher's lounge for 15 minutes and just listen to the interaction of teachers. Mm-hmm. I can tell you if it's a healthy school or if there's some problems, but just by listening to the banter and the laughter and whatever else is going on there, you can tell the difference when that's a learning environment that kids need to be around. And I didn't create it. I just copied what I saw other teachers doing and this positive attitude and tried to figure out, so how do I apply that to what I'm trying to do?
So you offer workshops around the country for science teachers. What can a teacher expect when they come to one of your workshops?
They will expect never to have 5 points in a poem. and they will probably not see any PowerPoint unless I'm showing them a video of blowing up something or whatever. They're going to expect hands-on activities. They're going to expect stuff. If you could see around my desk, you'd see there's ropes sitting here because I'm playing with this. They would, here, let me, I'm going to ask Callie because I'm going to show you something. Come on up. I'm sitting in my office now, and it is Cyber Tuesday or whatever. So the little elves at SteveSpanglerScience.com are putting lots of stuff in bags right now. There, so it's a busy time. But if they come to a workshop, they can expect that within the first 5 minutes, a teacher's going to go, "Oh, he's a teacher." Because they're going to be able to see, and you and I know that. We've been into in-services before when you see somebody who has some pretty good ideas but hasn't been in the classroom for 20 years.
Right.
And you see other people who are, like you are, in the classroom, connected to the classroom, working with teachers or whatever, and kind of go from there. So, and they can expect to see some kind of hands-on things. I got to show you something that I'm playing with. All right, so cool. Take a look at this. It's called an energy stick. Don't know if you've seen one before. Come on in, Kelly, you're fine. So this is an energy stick. This is there's some little LEDs, and there's a piece of aluminum foil here and aluminum foil here, and then there's a battery here. And there's no switch or anything like that, but if I put my hand here and I put my hand here, see how it goes off?
Yeah.
I get it fun? So it's just a conductivity tester, right? Yeah. Silly. So if I hold here and I touch here, I connect. If I hold here and I touch here, I don't connect because my sweater is an insulator, but my skin is a conductor. So I guess I could just teach you a lesson about insulators and conductors, and we could maybe even, I don't know, hold a piece of metal between us or something. But here, Callie, come on in here. So this is Callie.
Hi, Callie.
If I hang on here and Callie hangs on there, here, hold it with the other hand. Oh, it's broken. So see how it doesn't work?
Uh-huh.
You know, it doesn't work because we didn't form a connection. So watch this. If we reach out and hold hands, bingo, now it works.
Yeah, cool.
Now, that's cool. A workshop. You can, now if any teacher's watching this now, I've blown it. If you come to a workshop, you can expect I will lead you down the path to make you think that something's not going to work. Like, for example, I'll say in the instructions, one person holds here, another person holds here, that doesn't work at all. And they're the ones that will go, oh, yeah, it does. Yeah, look at that. We made a connection. And so now it's them learning just like kids do. But now here, watch this. watch, I can hang on to Callie, but it doesn't work. So you see how I'm holding onto her and this doesn't work? I can move her around, I can manhandle her, whatever. This doesn't work. It's only when we touch that it works. And look, we don't have to, we can connect like this. Is that great? But this is more interesting. Watch this. That's a lot more interesting, right? So that's more, here, I'll do it this way. That's more interesting than touching here, right? We got to be careful, because I'd have 28 after this, all right? So I see how this, but see that? If you're fighting, thank you, Callie. Yep. Nice job.
Nice to meet you.
Hey, see, the deal is this. If I can get a teacher in a workshop to go, I got an idea. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to get a bunch of kids to connect. And what if I got this kid to connect and this kid to, and another teacher goes, you know what? I think you helped me define the role of what I was supposed to learn in the workshop, and it wasn't about this. It was about connecting with kids in the most interesting way possible.
Yeah.
See, I could use a demonstration and just say, here, 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 step, 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 and it blows up. Then the kids are going to come in and go, I really like that. Give me a bigger explosion next time. And the next time they come in, bigger explosion. And all of a sudden you're trying to do this. But that's not what it's about. I can tell you a room of kids, and one of these, I was in Emporia, Kansas, in Emporia University, 350 leadership kids. These are high school kids. That's going to eat a science guy alive. You know, what does a science guy have to do to talk about student leadership? Yet that was the goal, to come in. And that energy stick, well, everybody got one. We didn't tell them that they were going to get one. One energy stick and 350 student leaders. And the idea was this: can we connect in such a way that when you put that in the circle, that little bit of energy, a volt and a half, connect all the way around? And the answer is yes, but it's knowing how to connect to the other person in such a way that we share a connection all the way around. It's building a connection. And I love, I guess the thing that I'm really passionate about anymore is to find how people are using regular science demonstrations to teach concepts that you and I never would have thought to teach. You know the thing, the elephant's toothpaste? Remember elephant's toothpaste?
Yeah, I love that one.
30% hydrogen peroxide, potassium iodide, put it in there, flows all over the place. I'm watching people in business ask how to do this, because at a business sales convention or a conference, they want to talk about erupting enthusiasm. They want to talk about this liquid that has tremendous potential, but you can't release the potential by adding water to it or shaking it up or doing whatever. You have to have a little catalyst, and it has to be the right catalyst. But once that catalyst hits and you've got the perfect environment, look at what you get. Well, it's not teaching science, but it's a hell of a demo. You know, and it's, if you're trying to get people, because they're going to be interested, they're going to go, what was that liquid? And you go, hydrogen peroxide, 30% hydrogen peroxide. It's actually H2O plus O2 equals hydrogen peroxide, and you're releasing those bubbles, and that's why you put it on a cut. See what just happened? I'm teaching, but I'm not teaching the typical classroom kind of environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Call it what it is. I get excited because other people get excited, and that's very viral.
Right.
Yeah. And that's why YouTube approached us and said, all right, these science demos that you're doing, it's the largest growing area in the YouTube audience, is people putting up science experiments and educational kinds of things on YouTube. And that's how we got partnered up with YouTube EDU, because so many people wanted to do it and share it. And that's the reason why the Mentos thing took off. It wasn't because of any great marketing thing. It's because we were at a point in time where kids are going, not only am I going to try this at home, because everybody's been saying, don't do this at home, right? Or don't try this at home. Everything is don't try this at home. But now all of a sudden you get somebody who goes, not only am I going to try the Mentos thing at home, I'm going to do it with 100 bottles. I'm going to videotape this. I'm going to put it online. And back in 2005, we didn't know about pay-per-click and all those other things. We were just looking at how many people are watching this kind of thing. It's just very viral.
Well, you know, you mentioned your YouTube channel, and it has some really incredible demos, and you have lots of subscribers. What role has video played in your business? And, you know, we've got to ask, who is that guy in the hipster t-shirt that's in most of your videos?
Can you tell it's not me, because I'm not that thin? See, I'm trying, but this is what happens when you get to be 47. You try hard, man. You really, really try hard. Video plays a tremendous role, and video played in a tremendous role, and we didn't even know it. So it was just a gut-level instinct. I'd been doing television all this time, and you archive the TV spots, but what do you do with them other than a TV station in 1997, no online video. So think about when online video really started playing, maybe 2002, 2003. And even then, very costly to stream. I had an IT person at a television station I was working at come to me and said, I've noticed that people, this is in 2003, people outside of Colorado are watching your videos. We want to know why. And you go, I think it's a thing called the internet, but I'm not sure. And he goes, yes, but that costs us a lot of money. Today, that's the whole role, right? But back then, it was like, how do we do this? So who would have guessed that in September of 2005, that dropping Mentos into a Diet Coke that I had done on television three or four times before that, at that moment in time, would become viral? And the reason it became viral is because that video, along with a blog, who was blogging, except people probably like you and people who were in the audience, right? How I was just advised to blog. I didn't know anything about it, but I had an advisor who told me the best thing you could do is blog. Just put the stuff out there and blog. Mm-hmm. So the blog post, I didn't put it out. The blog post that went out from the Associated Press was, news anchor gets soaked, science experiment goes awry. What does that mean? So people tune in, and here is this guy with a bottle of Diet Coke and a bottle of Diet Pepsi. And the reason why it was Diet is because we didn't want it sticky on the table to clean up. It wasn't because of nucleation points or the rate of reaction or what everybody has hypothesized. It's just because I didn't want to get sued, so we did Diet Pepsi and Diet Coke, so those are the two big guys, so whatever. And I guess the Mentos people would like it. I'm not sure. And we just shot it up in the air. Well, she gets soaked, right? She gets soaked three times because on live TV, this beautiful lady in St. John's outfit, her name's Kim Christensen, laughs even today about it. She gets so excited, she doesn't pull away. She goes all over. So what do they talk about for the next 3 hours on live TV? Oh, Kim, you're soaked. It's Mentos and Diet Coke. They started it. So if anybody ever wants to know what happened, it's because of that day at that time, those people continued to say Mentos and Diet Coke. No matter how much money Pepsi's tried to put into it, it'll never be Mentos and Pepsi. Wow. It'll always be Mentos and Diet Coke. And we thought we were going to get sued. We contacted the Mentos people back in 2000, 2001, and their marketing brand people didn't want to talk to us at all. But it's amazing, in about November of 2005, we get a call from the Perfetti Van Mel people, and we thought we were going to get sued. I turned to my wife and I said, well, we're going to get sued for doing the Mentos thing. And they said, all right, you've got our attention. What do you want? And that's a great situation to kind of be in. So we're very thankful to them with the license agreement that we have with them and all the toys that have come out as a result of it. And it all started because of a silly little video that went viral. And we didn't even know what that meant at the time.
So is that still the most one of your most popular YouTube videos then?
No, that's the silliest thing you would think.
Really?
Yeah, you know. So what does the Today Show pick up a couple months ago? Eating nails for breakfast, where we all take a neodymium bag and take it out of Total Cereal. What else do people like? I'll give you. They like anything they can do at home. So we were commissioned by YouTube. YouTube came to us almost 2 years ago, exactly, and said if we gave you some money to do a show. We can talk about it now because we're outside of the non-disclosure or whatever, but if we gave you some money to do a show, could you do a show and what would you do? And we went, yeah, I think we could do a show. We got probably 1,000 segments in the can, and I bet you we could go back through and see some of the best ones with that. And they said, what would you do and what would you be able to do that you couldn't do on television? So when we came up with the idea of the Spangler Effect, and that's a name that they kind of came up with, a person at YouTube watching all the stuff said, I think that there's an effect that you have on people who watch the videos. They just want to try the stuff at home. And so that's how the Spangler Effect came about. And I can tell you that the first 12 episodes of the Spangler Effect, directed by Bradley Mayhew and Brian Higgins, who helps out with it, Higginsworth, who's on the show, it would go like this. Here's a soda can, and I'm going to teach you how to crush it by heating it up and putting it in water. Mm-hmm. Then here's a bigger can, and we're going to crush the crap out of that. And then here's a 55-gallon drum. And as soon as you get to the 55-gallon drum, we watched over 60% of our audience click off. And we watched that pattern show after show after show until we sat down and looked at it and said, what's the pattern here? People stay involved when they can do it. But we thought it would be really cool. Like, I guess we got the money now. Let's get a tanker and put it out there and crush a tanker. That'll be no. People don't want to see that, but that's what every producer at the Discovery Channel continues to pitch to us. Well, let's take a small experiment and make it big. And the secret is, let's take a small experiment and make it awesome. And if you can take a small experiment and make it awesome, that's totally viral.
What about like top-selling products that you have in your store? What's your top-selling product?
We sell a lot of, I wish I had one sitting here. We sell a lot of baby soda bottles. You know what baby soda bottles are?
Yeah, I've seen those.
2-liter bottles before they've been blown up. Why? Not because everybody wants baby soda bottles, but thanks to lots and lots of teachers and lots ideas, there are a ton of activities to do in baby soda bottles. Mm-hmm. Insta-snow is super popular. Color-changing beads, the Mentos, Geyser and Geyser cars and those things. You know, it's amazing. Whatever is popular is what we play with online. So if we do a video of us playing with a fun fly stick, which is a static electricity thing where you take some tinsel and you float it in the air, it's not my creation, but I love it, and the people who invented it were nice enough to be able to share it with us. If we play with it and show the potential, then all of a sudden that product becomes popular, and it's just human nature. Isn't that true? Mm-hmm. That you see somebody use something and go, I need that, because they immediately see themselves doing it and they see the effect that they'll have on students when they're students. Every teacher, think about it, every teacher wants to be in front of a classroom and have 27 kids go, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Do that again. The first time a kid ever did this to me, I was making slime. I had only been teaching for probably a year, but I'm in the classroom and I'm going to make slime and I'm showing them the recipe with borax and with Elmer's glue, and a kid goes like this, a third grader goes like this, could you hang on a second? I got to get a pencil and write that down. And the teacher looks at me and she goes, he's never asked to write down anything that I've had in class. But for some reason, idiot boy comes in with borax and Elmer's glue, and this kid goes, I got to write that down. Hold on. Because it's important, right? And it's not because I'm an amazing teacher. It's because we couched it and created an experience where a kid goes, I got to do that. And in the meantime, guess what he's learning about? Polymers and cross-linking and monomers and dimers and trimers and whatever else. And he doesn't realize that, but in order to have that formula that he needs, he has to have the other pieces that are there. It's kind of cool.
So this is happening with all the core subjects, but we'll talk about it specific to science. How do you feel about science curriculum becoming kind of more standardized around the classrooms throughout the country?
I think that a standardized curriculum would be great if it were standardized, mm-hmm. but it's not. And so this is where I start to get into trouble, because I've gotten this opportunity. You laugh.
This isn't a setup, I promise.
It's going to be a problem. Because here's the thing is, I love the fact where we go, we all are standardized. That's what we're going to do. We're going to be standardized. And Texas goes, well, but not us. It's good. I like the idea, but we really have got some stuff, and we're going to do it this way. And Colorado goes, you know, we're not going to become one of those states. We like most of the ideas of NGSS, but we've got our own. And California says we're going to do our thing in Florida. So I really wish it was standardized, but it's not. And I can remember going to Canada speaking for the Science Teachers Association of Ontario back in 95, I think, and listening to them what a real standardized curriculum is all about. It's pretty standardized, almost crazy standardized, right? And I got an opportunity with my wife to actually go back in a couple weeks ago and speak at the STAO conference. And they laugh because it was the same kind of question that you're asking, but they're laughing because they said, you know, when NSTA came out and said, here's next generation science standards, one of the guys at STAO said, I went up to the president of NSTA after this announcement and handed him our document, because we knew they were going to do it anyway. He says, and so here's our document from 7 years ago that's exactly the same as what you guys are doing. We already have 7 years under our belt. Be happy to share with you kind of some of the problems and successes and so forth. But it's kind of funny how we think that this is a new idea, and it's not necessarily a new idea. I am all for a standard, to be able to say that we think from a cognitive level that a first grader should understand this and a fifth grader should understand this is fantastic, especially for that poor kid who moves from Connecticut to Texas to California and misses a huge chunk of curriculum. So, yes, but my response is, for God's sake, standardize it. If we're going to go for this, then standardize it. And you know, and the other piece that really just gets my goat is when people talk about STEM. I am so sick and tired of hearing about STEM this and STEM that, when you have people look at you and go, really? That's called Hands-On Science 1982. this is what we were doing back in the 80s. And I'm trying not to be a complete jerk about it, but at a certain point in your career, I think you just got to call it the way you see it. And it was really driven home. I was at a conference. This is a conference of science museums that gets together, and we were in Albuquerque. And I'm not going to tell you the name of the museum, but this museum wanted you to come by after the session and see all their STEM activities. They had done these great STEM activities, and they had worksheets. And one of the STEM activities was this. You collect leaves, and you put the leaves in a Ziploc bag, and when you take them back to your desk, you use a magnifying glass, and you examine the leaves, and it's a STEM activity.
No.
And you know what? It's not a STEM activity, but you know what they said? It's science because it's leaves, and that's biology. Mm. Technology is the magnifying glass, and engineering is, isn't it amazing how the world engineered this amazing tree and this leaf, and the kids had to count. And as funny as you and I might think that is, that's the reality.
Right.
And not everybody's doing STEM like that. I get it. But I have yet to look into an administrator's eyes or a teacher's eye. Most teachers don't say this to me, but they're administrators who say, you know, we're STEM focused now. Our district is STEM focused. And you say, what does that mean? And they look at you, and you just start to see this. Means that we got a lot of computer. Kids are doing computers, and they're doing science, and we got computer labs, and you know it's engineering and math too. And I've been saying, but for what reason? What are you going to get out of the deal? Because this is the greatest marketing ploy that science education has ever had. Foundations didn't pour millions of dollars into hands-on science, but they're pouring millions of dollars into STEM. Why? Because it's the greatest marketing initiative ever. Now, nobody can tell me what qualifies this to be a STEM activity, right? I don't know if this is a STEM activity or not. It looks like there's some engineering and some science and some technology, but nobody can say that's it because I have yet to see a document that says this qualifies as STEM or this is what we're trying to get out of it. You know, there was a Top Gun moment where the Navy wanted to have all these pilots and the Air Force wanted the pilots, so there's this little movie produced called Top Gun, remember? And what was the initiative there? We need pilots. That's what we need. We need pilots. And they got their Top Gun moment. And we as scientists and as educators need our Top Gun moment for scientists for this new generation, this next generation. The U.S. Navy, we got a chance, I was working with a gentleman by the name of Richard Hudson, who was the creator of Newton's Apple. And Spy Girls and things like that. And he says, I got to have you look over this document and talk to this person. He says, we're working with the U.S. Navy. So here I'm talking to this person from the U.S. Navy who says, the money's not the problem. The problem is this. Our projections show in the next 15 to 20 years, we will not have enough American-grown scientists to fulfill the jobs that we need in the next 15 to 20 years. We are at national risk because of that. That's your STEM moment. Right? That's the moment in time where you go, this is what we're after. You know what I'm after? I'm after wonder and experimentation and exploration and discovery. If I could say every activity I do has to have wonder, experimentation, exploration, and discovery, what does that spell? Weed. That spells weed. You know what that spells? W-E-E-D. It's not just because I'm from Colorado, right? That spells weed. And you know what the thing is with weed? Is that weeds grow incessantly, and you can try to kill them, and they're still rooted in the ground. And I can pull them up, and the things still grow, and they spread. And it's almost impossible to stop. And if I'm going to be behind an initiative, I want something that's impossible to stop. I want kids to be able to have the tools that they need to succeed in the future. And I think that wonder and exploration and experimentation and discovery and the scientific method have all got to be a part of that, not just a fancy term that we put on something. And 10 years later, we sit there and we look at it and go, so now what's the next term that we're going to use?
Right.
So in elementary and in middle school, we do well, you know, biology and the physical sciences and force and motion, those kinds of things. But we don't do computer science as well. Is that coming, do you think?
I don't know, and I don't know that I'm qualified to speak that we don't do computer science well. So I'm gonna take your word for it that we
okay.
don't.
I feel like we don't.
What we don't do well is we don't do a good job of respecting the fact that we need to be taught. Mm-hmm. We as teachers need professional development more than life itself. We need somebody to teach us how to be better teachers.
Right.
Because the world just changed in an amazing way in the last 5 years. When my kid looks at me and we're sitting there doing something on the weekend and my kid goes like this, hey, Dad, how many I'll just Google it. Don't worry about it. And he reaches for his phone and you go, wait, no. I used to be that guy. Ask me the question. Nah, this answers it right here. I just type it in right here. And so it's my job not to be the content manager, but I've got to somehow be the facilitator of information. I got to go to my 10-year-old or my 11-year-old and say, Why do you want to know about Triton, which is a moon, I guess, a moon of Neptune or something? And the reason he wants to know about it is because there's liquid nitrogen on it. and nitrogen is a solid, liquid, and gas. I go, how do you know that? He goes, cool YouTube video. Really? When did you see a cool YouTube video? Well, when I was over on the computer. Really? So on your own, you found a YouTube video about a moon, and you want to know about liquid nitrogen, and you're coming and asking me, but now you're going to go to Google? I have to, as a teacher, learn how to grab that and go, well, wait, let's build some connections. So right. What do you want to know, and what could we do next, and what resources are out there to help him grow in that way? Because I don't have to be the conduit through which all the information flows. But somebody has to teach me how to be a facilitator, because I'm not the world's best facilitator, but there are some really great people who could teach me.
You know, I love that you bring that up, because that really is the world that we live in. I mean, this morning we were talking about, we were doing some writing activity, and the starfish came up. And one of the kids, they were like, is a starfish a fish? And I was like, I'm not sure. I don't know what to do. And they were like, well, I'll just go Google it. And so they went and Googled it, and then they were like, hey, can you, and then they made these funny comments. They're like, tweet that out, because we tweet as a class. So I tweeted it out, and one of my followers does these video segments that are educational, and she saw it, and she tweeted back, and she was like, hey, we did a lesson over starfish in our videos. And so I was like, hey, guys, we just got a tweet back, and we pulled up a video and watched it, and we had all this great learning experience just from being these connected people that in the past I would have just been like, I don't know what a starfish is. Let's move on.
Bingo. And you said the word. You were connected. Where is that in this whole science initiative that we're looking at? Where is communication, writing, passion, connectedness, marketing, all these other things that go into it? You go, how in the world, honestly, did Steve Spangler just say marketing when we're talking science? Yeah, because I don't know of anybody who gets funded unless you know how to write. And if you don't know how to write with some keywords and you don't know how to write with copy that's going to intrigue somebody, how in the world are you ever going to get funding? And how in the world is this great idea ever going to come to fruition? But the mere fact that your kids thought, because this is the way they're wired now, tweet that out. They have information. They made a discovery, right? So they went through this whole process. They wondered. There was a little exploration. Is it a starfish? Is it a fish or whatever? They didn't have to experiment. They just went over and they made the discovery with a little research, and now it's like, I got to share that. That's a very, very powerful thing that we have to teach kids and we have to embrace. And we as teachers need to take these computer labs and all this technology that we've been given and the iPad per kid and whatever initiative that you have out there, teach kids how to communicate with other human beings and get them as fired up about whatever they're doing. And that's hard to stop. That is something that is impossible to stop. That you come full circle. That passion, that analogy that we use as a weed, I have to really work hard to eradicate weeds from my yard. And I have to go to extreme measures, finding poison to kill them. I would love to have an initiative that you have to find something and try to eradicate it. And it'd be impossible. It sprouts up everywhere.
Well, you know, one question that – go ahead, Chris.
I was going to ask the other one first real quick. We got two more left. We're almost done here. So how does failure play an important part in science? And have you had moments of failure yourself that you kind of reflect on or have had to reflect back on?
Oh, absolutely. Let's take the question, how does it play in science? I think that we have raised a generation of kids that are now young adults that believe that science is a 3.5-minute thing because that's what they've always seen. They really didn't go through the rigors of, many of them didn't have to take a lab class, many of them don't realize or got frustrated that when they did the experiment that you had to actually wait for a period of time. And we engineered these experiments because you've got to get through this much content in this much time, so we better engineer it so that everybody's at least successful so we can get some data, and then they can write up their lab report, and then we can have this notebook over here, and then we can – so all these things that you see versus a kid who sits there and looks and says, this experiment totally didn't work, totally didn't work, and that's called a discovery. Right? So you make these little discoveries along the way. We don't write a conclusion until you've made 100 discoveries, 1,000 discoveries. You know, you don't watch CSI and they give you the kicker in the first 30 seconds and then you just sit there and watch the rest of it. You get to see an hour's worth of little mini discoveries and little experimentation and more discoveries until finally you come to a conclusion. So I'll go so far as to, and I don't know if it's a setup question or not because there's stuff that I've written before about failure, but I'll go so far as to engineer the failure into a lesson. So if we're doing something that's simple like in elementary, like chromatography, where everybody takes a vis-a-vis pin, you know, the water-soluble pins, mm-hmm. you're supposed to put them on filter paper, then you're supposed to drip the water, and you're supposed to see the colors. I'll go so far as to sneak in some black Sharpie pens with all the other vis-a-vis. So let's just say there's 26 kids. 24 kids work perfectly, and 2 kids don't work at all. And it's great to watch those 2 kids because they'll either A, ditch the pen and go steal somebody else's pen and do another one because they know, look, I got to get the right result, or B, they're pissed. This does not work. And now they want to know why. And as a teacher, if I can learn to turn that around, that person or those 2 people made a discovery that, look, the teacher put the wrong pen down. And why did he put the wrong pen down? I don't know, but why is it the wrong pen? Because that's a permanent pen. This is a water-soluble pen. How do you get permanent pen to move? And what does that lead you into? It's that Sharpie pen activity where you put the Sharpie pen dots on the T-shirt, the Bob Becker activity, and you squirt the rubbing alcohol and it forms this beautiful pattern. Well, I could either do that activity as an arts and crafts, or I could incorporate it into this failure thing that now all of a sudden I'm building an experience. I'm building something that feels organic. It feels like it's great. And I think that failure piece fits in there very nicely. Another quick example, floating and sinking soda cans. You know how you take a Diet Coke and drop it in water and it floats, and a regular one, it sinks. So here I thought for this group of fourth graders, this would be great. So I went to Home Depot. I got 8 buckets, 8 orange buckets. Filled the buckets up half full. Kids are out at lunch, going to come back. They each have 8 cans of soda around the bucket. So they've got Diet Coke, regular Coke, Mountain Dew, but I've got a nice variety of diet and regular. What I'm doing is when they come back in, I'm telling them we're not doing a floating activity, so I don't tell them that at all. I say to them, we're going to do the rolling can activity where we get to roll them down the hallway, but one of the cans exploded in the back of my car. So if you wouldn't mind, put all the cans in the water, wash them off, pull them back out again, and then we're going to go out in the hallway and throw them down the hall. So here's my hope, is that the kids are going to put them in the water, and the smart kid's going to go, some are floating and some are sinking, and then they're going to categorize it. You know, they don't do that at all. You know what they did? Put them all in there, get them out, pull them all back out again. Now we're ready to go. And you're going, did you guys see anything? No. Well, you better wash them again. So they're putting them all in. So here I am walking around going, some are, look at that. I wonder why those are floating and they're sinking. And this little girl looks at me, fourth grade, looks at me, and she goes, oh, I know why they're floating. And I go, oh, why are they floating? She goes, you got gypped. I go, what do you mean it got gypped? And she goes, there's less soda in this can than there is in this can. And you see how organically it just happened? I didn't expect this to happen. So what am I doing? I'm eating into some other time that we should be doing social studies or reading or something, popping open cans, trying to measure out. I don't have beakers, so I'm trying to measure out both of them, going 355 milliliters, 355. And it led to this process where I realized that nobody had ever allowed them to slow down for a second and wonder and reflect and write it down and realize that this is what scientists really do, that there's these great discoveries in front of us. And when you say to me, Todd, that a kid was so excited that they're going to tweet it out, that's the best part of this entire interview for me, is that you know that there's hope in the world when a kid looks at you and goes, we've got to tweet that out. How important is it to tweet out as a starfish or regular fish or whatever? It doesn't matter. He could hardly or she could hardly wait to tell the rest of the world. And that's the kind of movement that I want to be behind. That's a good idea.
Well, you know, that leads great into our final question. If somebody were to ask you, you know, what are you really passionate about right now? What would you say you're really passionate about?
Connecting kids to information. And I will show you. So I told you I had ropes on the table. So let me show you the little rope thing, the little puzzle that you need home, and maybe it'll be a good demonstration. All right, so take a look at this. I've got these big ropes. So if I stand back, can you still hear me and you can kind of see what's going on?
I'm
looking in there. All right, so a great big piece of rope. So if you said this great big long piece of rope represents everything that we learned from the beginning of time until about 1900, it would represent this big piece of rope. And so they tell you that from 1900 to 1950, information doubled. So I'd have 2 pieces of rope. And then from 1960 to 1970, it doubled again. And so now it's doubling every 18 months. So you can imagine how long the piece of rope is. But this is everything and all the information you could ever imagine. And the middle-sized piece of rope, so it's a little bit smaller, represents standards. And we talked about it in the interview. And standards are made by people and boards of education and human beings, people who just simply say, this is our standard of excellence. We know we get a touchdown when you go 100 yards. We know that we hit the end. This is our standard. Here's how we're going to measure what we're going to do. And the last little piece of rope that we forget about sometimes is the kid, right? It's the student. It's the best commodity we have. But sometimes that little thing gets lost. And so in education, we do this. We organize. So we take the student, we take the standard, and we take the information. And like any good educator, you take, and an administrator does this the best. They just mix everything up like this. So they reorganize, because we've all gone through reorganization. And the object is to get them all the same length. And the way to do that is years of practice and self-denial, but that's how it looks. See how it looks there? So that you look at it and you go, the standards are the same as the kid, that's the same, for example, as the content. And you look at it this way. I don't know how well you can see it from how far away, but you say that's what we're looking for, is we're looking for a way to be able to connect them together. And the only reason I do this last little part is so that you know when the silly trick is done, with a short, a medium, and a long one. All right, so I got to show you how it works. Watch this. So the ropes don't stretch, but watch what happens. It's all a matter of organization. So there's got to be a reason that you wake up in the morning and you have passion for what you do. And it's all in the goal. So here, you see it's short, medium, long, and I'm just going to organize them again, short, medium, and long. And now watch what happens. This is the part that looks like magic. So here, watch what happens. It looks like they're stretching. So you see what it looks like? See how it looks like it's stretching? Yeah. But what you have to realize is this. The first rope is the standard. So you see the rope there? That's the middle-sized rope. That's the standard. The standard never changes. It's linking the kid to the content. So you see what we did here? We took all that information that I said was there, and you link it to a kid. And as long as you take content and you link it to a student, you can hold it up against any standard, and it will always measure out. So when I think of standards, I think of the importance of linking kids to content, and the standard will follow. And so if I can do something in the next 10 years, it's to provide teacher training and opportunities for teachers to be able to take their passion and to be able to take the content and what they've learned in some sort of environment and to truly make a difference in a kid's life, so that someday a kid comes to them and goes, hey, do you remember who I am? Do you remember me? You made a huge impact on my life and you didn't even realize it. And that's the greatest thing that could ever happen to a teacher.
Well, I love that trick. I always wondered how that. I thought it was just ropes that stretch.
That's so- Don't tell anybody. It's a secret. Yeah.
Chris, I feel like we're watching Dave Burgess again with the magic.
I know. I was just gonna. I'm gonna tweet to Dave that he needs to look out because we got a new sheriff in town.
Oh my gosh.
We had a former guest that did an interactive card trick with the audience and stuff.
Oh, that's cool.
He's an author, yeah. So he was real proud of that trick, and it was awesome. But now we got some competition.
Yeah. It's just a way to connect.
That's right. Perfect. Yeah, we really appreciate you coming on. This has been, we had this on the books for quite some time, and I've been really looking forward to it, and I know Todd has as well. So just thank you so much for being here and joining the podcast and spending a little extra time than we normally do, and it was just amazing. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for what you do, for the time that you're taking, for a forum for other educators to be able to connect and see what we're doing. We work in such a silo in education that we kind of close our door and we hope that what we're doing is great. And all of that's changing because of people like you and being able to share just strategies and hopefully to have some things that are confrontational. So it's something that people don't agree with necessarily, but if it gets them talking and the dialogue started and you're facilitating that, I can't thank you enough for what you're doing.
Awesome. And just a couple of quick bits of contact information. What can you tweet out speak out your Twitter handle?
Sure, it's just @SteveSpangler. So yeah, at Steve Spangler. And on Facebook, facebook.com/SteveSpangler. And if you want to connect with us online, you can go to SteveSpanglerScience.com. It seems like there's a pattern here. And if you want to join us over on YouTube, you can go to youtube.com/SteveSpanglerScience or just type in the Spangler Effect or search for Sick Science. We didn't talk about it at all, but I'd love your audience to see the resource. If they don't know about this free resource that's out there, just look for Sick, S-I-C-K, Science, because every teacher wants to be a sick teacher. It's vernacular that they came up with. You know how it works. So.
Yep, I got
it. We'll definitely put all that up on our website so that everybody can have all those links and access to all that.
Nice. Thanks, guys. Really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, take care.
Thanks.
If you want to connect with us, you can catch us at Twitter at EduAllStarsHQ. Hashtag is EduAllStars. We also blog at EduAllStars.com. You can find all the former episodes there, our previous episodes. And then on iTunes, you can just search out EduAllStars with no spaces and see the 25 episodes we've done prior to this one.
And we're excited about some of the upcoming guests that we have booked for y'all. Next Wednesday, December the 11th at 8 p.m. Central, we have Tony Vincent. And then on Sunday, December the 15th, we at 7 p.m., we will be featuring Amy Meyer. And then again on Wednesday, December 18th, we're going to have librarian Shannon Miller. And so we've got some really exciting people coming up that we can't wait to have you hear their stories. And we want to encourage you. We've had a great time just reading some of the reviews on iTunes and hearing what people think about the show. So we appreciate it if you could go online and leave us ratings on iTunes and give us some feedback. We'd appreciate it. Thank you again, Steve, for coming on. We had a great time learning from you, and we just really appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Thank you very much. It was fun.